Last time we covered Genesis chapter 2, chapter 1, a little bit about God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them male and female. And for this cause, he said, shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. So we have statements. And then we saw that God created, and the word man is Adam. And then you see in Genesis chapter 5 and verse 1 and 2, this is the book of the generations of Adam. It's the generations of Adam in the day when God created Adam. And the word man is the word Adam. And he made him in the likeness of God. He created them, male and female, and blessed them and named them. He named them Adam or man. It's the Hebrew word that's often translated man, Adam, the first man. He named them, both of them, male and female, were named Adam. And in Genesis chapter 6, we see, and it came about, chapter 6 and verse 1, it came about when Adam, or men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them. Do you think daughters are born to men? So when the word men has to include male and female, daughters were born to them as male and female. Adam is male and female. And last time we came to the picture of Christ and the church. For this reason, a man leaves his father and mother. And it's quoted all the way down in the book of Ephesians chapter 5 and in verse 31. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great. But I am speaking in reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. So it's a combination of things here, a combination. Now, we talked about the thing of in verse 23, for the husband is the head of the wife, and then it says the wife should submit herself. And we're going to talk about those issues. What does that mean, head? We talked about it a little bit in the book of 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 3. I want you to know, to understand, that Christ is the head of every man. The man is the head of a woman. And God is the head of Christ. Now, here's the question. Does the word head mean boss or ruler? Or does it mean source or origin? That's the question. And different people have different arguments on it. I understand that. I'm going to try to explore a little bit. Let's go back in history for a minute. Some of you may have heard of the name Irenaeus, spelled I-R-E-N-A-E-U-S, Irenaeus, one of the early church fathers. Now, Irenaeus used the word head as source, and he wrote about that the head or source of his own being. I have a head, my head is the source of my own being. So when a child is first born, the biggest part of that child as it's growing in the womb is the head. All the nerve structures are coming from the head. And it goes from the head all the way through the entire body, all the way down this. Everything comes from the head. I was talking to a man who once lost his lower leg, okay? He didn't have a foot, didn't have a lower leg. But he said, you know, I still feel sometimes my toes itch. And he wants to reach down and do his toes, but the nerves coming to his brain for the toes still is there, and the toes are itching, but there are no toes to itch. He can't scratch the toe. It's not there. Hippolytus, another early Christian, emphasized that productivity of the bodily member when he designated the head as the characteristic substance from which all people were made. Your whole being comes from your head. Your nerves, all the nerves come through here. One chiropractor, or he was studying to be a chiropractor, he said, you know, when you slouch down and you sit on your spinal column, you're sitting on your head. You know, you're because that's the nerve system. Everything comes through your spinal column, all the nerves. Philo declared, as though the head of, this is a quote, as though the head of a living creature, Esau is the progenitor of all these members. He's talking about Esau's children, you know, the people that grew up from him. Esau is as though he were the head of a living creature. Esau was the source, the progenitor. He brought all these people. He engendered all these people. The word kephale. Kephale is the Greek word for head. Kephale. Kephale was considered by Photius to be a synonym for procreator or progenitor, a synonym for that. So the concept of head as a source or a beginning point, is readily apparent even in Paul's writings. What did Paul mean when he said head? Well, let's look at some of his other writings. We know what some history said, but let's look at what Paul wrote. Kephale. This is Colossians chapter 1 and verse 18. He is also the head of the body, which is the church. And he is the beginning, that's arche. Arche is the beginning. He is the head, he's the beginning, he's the firstborn. Listen to these three statements. He's the head, he's the beginning, he's the firstborn. What are you saying about this? They're talking about Jesus Christ. Head, beginning, and firstborn. Now, if you're going to say beginning and firstborn, those are two of the leading things, right? The firstborn, he's the firstborn from the dead. He's the firstborn from the dead. And that's so that he himself will come to have, I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, he himself will come to have first place in everything. So how is Paul using the word head in Colossians 1 and verse 18? Well, he's the boss of the body, and he's the beginning, and he's the firstborn, and he has to have first place. Well, first place and boss are two different things. So the source, the beginning, the place from which it comes, Paul's own writings suggest that the word head means source. As an aside, however, we should recall that the head is the part of the body which is actually, unless it's a breech birth, born first. What part of the body of a child is usually, except for breech birth, which is unusual, born first, the head. The head comes into existence first, and Jesus Christ was the firstborn from the dead, the firstborn of all creation. While there was debate as to whether the head or the breast or the stomach was the dwelling place of the mind, you know, people put the mind everywhere, you know, the head is the first thing that was born. And many philosophers said, well, where is the brains? Where is it? Where does the mind happen? Which organ takes care of which is issued? And what is the importance? Most notably, speech is the most important, right? Your speech comes from your head. The head resembled a spring from which the power flowed to the body. Now, since that time, we have done many experiments, and we know. And what does the Bible say? It's all in the Bible there, too. What does the Bible say? A merry heart. The heart, again, means mind. The mind, the location of out of the heart of man come evil thoughts. So that's what we're talking about, the mind. If your brain is happy, if your brain is healthy, if you have happiness in your brain, guess what that does for your body? Makes your body healthier. Depressed people do not do as well. People who are negative don't do as well. People who are down on themselves or down on others are not happy. They walk outside. They don't like anything. They say, oh, they want a nasty day. I don't like the flowers. I don't like anything. But that's not good for you. We also know, and there's been experiments on this, researchers have done it, why is it in these islands where they have all these shaman and superstitions and they have voodoo and they make this voodoo doll and they say, we're going to make this voodoo doll in your image and we're going to pierce it and you're going to die and then we're going to curse you and you die. And then all of a sudden they curse this person, this medicine man, this shaman, this fake, and he curses them. And sure enough, what happens? They start to shrivel. They start to feel down. They start to die. And what they found is, why did these people die when they were cursed? They believed the curse. They believed it. Their minds then began to turn on themselves and feel, I can't have any power. I'm subjected to this environment, and I believe this curse. Your brain can make you sick. Your brain can make you healthy. I had an uncle who married my mother's sister. Very nice guy, wonderful guy. He had to make it past his 64th birthday. He was not well. He had a lot of health problems. He had cancer and he was fighting. If he made it past his 64th birthday, she would inherit a lot more. He from his, I don't know what the circumstances were, but anyhow, he had to make it past there, and she would get a lot more benefits, financial benefits. And he held on. He just forced himself to stay alive. And sure enough, shortly after his 64th birthday, then he died. He held on. They thought he would die before that, but he determined with his will, I'm going to keep myself going. The brain has a lot of power, a lot of power in the body. It can upset your digestive system. It can upset your entire, your respiratory system. It can upset your blood type. And your blood, what do I want to say, blood panels. Your brain has a lot to do with your health. Being happy, feeling good and optimistic is a very powerful thing. The head. So the head is the spring from which the power flowed forth to the rest of the body and the rest of the organs. It was placed nearer the heavens, drawing, they thought, the ancients thought this, Philo said, it was drawing its power and distribution of the life force to every member of the body. It's closer to the heavens. It's closer up here. The concept of head as source of supply to the whole body is well attested in Paul's writings, and it's echoed by Paul here in the book of Ephesians. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 4. How does Paul use the word head in chapter 4? We saw that he's the head of the wife. The man is the head of the wife, and I believe that no matter what behavioral terms you put. If the husband is comatose, if the husband can't speak, if he's had an accident, if he's got brain damage, he's still the head of the wife. That's what the Bible says. I don't tie that to anything. She may be making all the decisions. She has all that, and she's the head. Now, if you think the head means the boss, if you think the head means he has to make all the decisions, then he can't make them. He's comatose. He's hit the head. He can't make them. His wife has to do all that. But he's still the head. The Bible says that. But let's take a look at how Paul uses the word head in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 15. But speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in all aspects unto him who is the head, even Christ. From whom? Okay, now Christ is the head. From whom? Listen to this in verse 16. The whole body being fitted and held together by what every joint supplies. The head, from whom all these things take place, according to the proper working of each individual part, causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself. The head, from whom the whole body being fitted. So after the head, the whole body is fitted, and a whole source of power, the whole source of power and nerves come from the head. So is the head boss or source? Let's take a look at another of Paul's writings in Colossians chapter 2. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 18. Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of angels, taking his stand on visions he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind. In other words, he's telling you, don't be deceived by these people, okay? And verse 19, this person, whoever this, he's dealing with a group of people, a group of people who are rejecting Christian doctrine. And then he said what they were not going. This person is not, listen, verse 19, not holding fast to the head. That person is not holding fast to the kephale. From whom? Again, the head. From whom? The entire body being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments, grows with a growth which is from God. So the head is the supplier. The head is where it flows. Let's take a look at Colossians chapter 2 now. In Colossians chapter 2, we read this in verse 9. For in him all fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. And in him you have been made complete, and he is the head over all rule and authority. Where does rule and authority come from? It comes from Jesus Christ. He's the source of all rule and all authority. Remember what Jesus said to Pilate when he was there? Pilate said, don't you realize I could condemn you, I could free you, I have all this power? And Jesus said, you wouldn't have any of that power. You get it from God. Who's the source of all your power? You got it from God. That's the source. Christ then is presented as the head, the source of the original power and ability needed for the believer's fulfillment, as he himself embodies all the fullness of the Godhead. You see that in Colossians 2. So let's come back to this passage of chapter 11. Chapter 11, let's drop down to verse 3. But I would have you to understand. I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man. Now, by the way, it doesn't say Christian man. It doesn't say every brother in Christ. He's the head of every man. Where Where did all creation come from? You read it in John chapter 1. Without him, nothing was made that was made. Jesus Christ was the source of all creation. All creation came from him. So he's the head of every man. And the man is the head of a woman. When God first created the woman, what did he do? Where did he take her? He didn't take her out of the dust of the ground. He took her from Adam's rib, right? That's the story we have in the book of Genesis. He took her from the rib of Adam. And he made her a woman. And he created her male and female. He called them both man. He called them both Adam. They're both, and they were both made in what? In what image? In the image of God. Now, by the way, don't think that means bodily image. Does the man look like God because his shoulders are broader and his hips are narrower, and the woman is her hip, generally her shoulders are narrower and her hips are broader? Well, does that mean that it's a bodily image? No, we're not talking bodily image. We're talking image of mind, the ability to talk, the ability to reason, the ability to build character, the ability to develop this godly character and have God's spirit in you and to respond to the Almighty God. That's the image that we're created in. Not a physical image of how tall you are, how short you are, you look, whether like a man or a woman or what. That's not the image. We're not talking a physical, bodily image. We're talking about a mental image. So he says, I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man and the man is the head of every woman. And God is the source, the head of Christ. Where did Jesus Christ come from as a human being? When he was transferred, the word was made flesh and dwelt among us. It was through the Spirit of God, and God made him. He called God his Father. Every man who has anything on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. But every woman who has her head covered or has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, for she is one and the same as the woman whose head is shaved. Now he's talking about this. Now, again, we have to ask the question, was this a local area issue or was it a universal area issue? Was this a local area to the Corinthians? What did the Corinthians, if you read the whole book, you read the 1 Corinthians letter, he said, I'm going to set straight. I know you're asking me a bunch of questions. I want to set straight with this thing. I'll give my opinion. I don't think this is the time for this is a rough time to get married. Yeah, but you have to do what you can. You know, if you're burning your passions, then I'd rather you marry rather than doing this. He talks about that. He corrects them about the way they were doing the Passover. You'll see it right here in chapter 11. He corrects them about going to eating. The Corinthians all of a sudden develop this idea. They've got lots of freedom. We're free in Christ. We can do all kinds of stuff. And so they began to, eat meat that was offered to idols. Now, Paul had to deal with that in chapters 9 and 10. This is a long time. What do we do about meat offered to idols? And he says, not everything that is permitted is always beneficial. It's not all good, all beneficial. And he talked to them about eating meat offered to idols. He goes back and forth. And he finally comes to this conclusion, if you read chapters 9 and 10 all the way through. He comes to the conclusion that, look, if you buy the meat in a meat market, and what those meat markets used to do was go to these local temples where they sacrificed the bull or they sacrificed the goat or something, and they pick up the meat. And they would sell it in the meat markets. We call the shambles in the King James, but the meat market is what it generally was. And he said, if you go there, Don't ask the question whether it had been offered to idols. Just don't ask, okay? And whatever is in the shambles, eat, asking no questions for conscience sake. Then you're going to have things and somebody's going to ask you, was this meat offered to idols? Well, I don't know. I bought it in the meat market and that was it. It's probably good meat and it hadn't been offered. But here's what the Corinthians got to do. They said, well, you know what? We worship God. That's not really an idol. That's just a statue. That means nothing. So these temples were sacrificing, and they had a meal there. Whatever meat they had left over, the shambles would take, but they had sometimes you could go in and have a meal. So let's just go in to the temple, and they're sacrificing this to their pagan god. But we'll sit down and we tell that God is nothing, that their gods are nothing, there's no nothing, and we'll just get a free meal. And Paul said, well, you know, I know that that's not anything, but let me ask you a question. He said, you know, we know that what they sacrifice, they're sacrificing the demons, and I don't want you sitting at the table of demons. I want you sitting at the table of the Lord. And you'll see that in the book of chapter 11 here. He talks about that. I don't want you to see at the Lord's table and at the table of demons. So he finally had to put a stop to some of it. He said, I just don't think that's right. Now they had a lot of freedom. Their women had a lot of freedom. Their women and their prophet, they had a lot of people that had prophesied with tongues. In chapter 14, he deals with tongues. I know you got a lot of gifts. Everybody was speaking in tongues. Everybody's got a vision. You're all in services. But he said, I want you to do it in order. I don't want everybody talking at once. I don't want everybody saying, you know, going ahead and interrupting everybody. It has to be done in order. 1, 2, 3, or 5 at the most, no more than 5 revelations or visions. And he talks about that. Okay, so we have a lot of freedom is going on in this church. A lot of people doing things that they, you know, they probably shouldn't do, or they could. But he said, I know all things are lawful. All things are permitted. Yeah, yes, you could do that. But it's not always beneficial to do. And he cites for himself, he and Barnabas. And are we the only two that have to work for a living? But I don't want to burden you. You should be paying my way, he said. But I don't want to burden you because you're suspicious of us. But Barnabas and I, now Cephas and the other apostles, they get to take their wives along, and the church pays for everything. But why do Barnabas and I have to do all the work? We have to earn our own living. Why is that? And he said, well, that's not the right thing. But I don't want to burden you. I'm not going to accept it from you because you're already suspicious of me, and I don't want to do that. So he said, so he was setting them an example that not all things, everything's permitted, but you don't have to do everything that's permitted. All right, so in 1 Corinthians, we read this. Every woman praying or prophesying with her head, every woman who does that uncovered is like as if she were shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off. But if it is disgraceful. And this is the whole thing. There was a culture around there in which it seemed to be disgraceful. Now, rabbis, many Jewish people, and the Corinthians, you know, they started in a synagogue. The synagogue was there, and many Jewish people said, you know, oh no, the rabbi said, if a woman, my wife is there, it's a reason to divorce her if she doesn't have her head covered, if she doesn't show this submissiveness. But is it disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved? Then let her cover her head. For a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God, and the woman is the glory of the man. Now, you'll hear him reasoning here through these passages. He's reasoning this. Now, listen to verse 6. For the man does not originate from the woman, but the woman from the man. For indeed, man was not created for the woman's sake, but the woman for the man's sake. What did God say? I will make a helper fitted for him, right? So he's now saying, see there, a woman was created for the man's sake. A woman originated from the man, not man from the woman. Verse 10. But I want you to notice verse 10. We got to read that verse very carefully. Therefore, the woman, he says, another translation, King James, for this cause ought the woman to have power on head. Translators don't quite know what to do with this verse. So here's how the New American Standard Version does. Therefore, the woman ought to have, and they put in here, a symbol of power, a symbol of authority. The word symbol is not there. It should read, the woman does have, ought to have authority. Okay, she ought to have the right on her head because, and she needs to be careful with it, that she has power over it and her discretion over it because of the angels. Now, where do we get that? Let's take a look at some of the deeper meanings of this verse. The word power, authority, it comes from the Greek word exousia. E-X-O-U-S-I-A, exousia. Here's the definition of the word exousia. It means, first of all, the power of choice. The liberty of doing as one pleases. If I have exousia, I have the right to do what I think is best, what I want to do. It means to have a leave or a permission. It means the physical and mental power. It means the ability or strength with which one is endued, which he either possesses or exercises his power. It means the power of authority or influence and the right or privilege of that power. It means the right or rule of government, the power to command if the others are in charge and to be obeyed. Universally over mankind, the authority over mankind, the power of judicial decisions. It means the authority to manage one's domestic affairs. It means a thing subject to authority or rule as well. Okay? One who possesses authority, a ruler, and so on. There's a lot of definitions of this word exousia. He's saying to you, okay, this is what I would interpret. For indeed, a man was not created for the woman's sake, but a woman for the man's sake. Therefore, a woman ought to have this power. But she needs to be careful because she has this freedom of authority, but she's got to be careful with it. I think he's talking, because of what? Angels. What does that mean, angels? The word angels is another word for messengers. What is an angel? A messenger. A person that carries a message. The angels came to carry a message. And these were messengers who could carry a report about the Christian women in Corinth. Okay, the Christian women. You'll see this in, you'll see the word exousia used here. Look at this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he uses the word, but he who stands firm in his heart, being under being not under no constraint, but has authority over his own will. He has exousia over his own will, the freedom of choice and power over his own will, and has decided this is in his heart to keep his own virgin daughter, keep his own virgin, the word daughter is not there, he will do well. If he wants to keep his virgin, he will do well. He makes his own decision on that. In chapter 8 and verse 9, But take care that this exousia, this liberty, this exousia of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. I know you have a lot of things in chapter 8 and chapter 9. I don't want you to use this and stumble. And notice in chapter 9 and verse 4, do we not have the right, the exousia, the power of will, the power of choice to eat and drink? Do we not have the right, the exousia, to take along a believing wife, Paul says, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I have a right to refrain, have no right to refrain from working? We have no exousia. Don't we have the right to? In chapter 9 and verse 12 of 1 Corinthians, if others have this exousia, freedom of choice, if others have this freedom of choice over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we do not use the right that we have. We're not using the exousia. So now he's trying to tell the Corinthians, look, I know you got a lot of freedom. I know a woman can actually make her own choice about how she wants to wear her hair, how she wants to do it. But I'm saying, look, there are messengers here that are carrying things across the way. There are messengers. And what are these messengers doing? Okay, Acts 18 and verse 6. Here was Paul at Corinth. He was preaching at the synagogue of the Jews. He was preaching there. But they started, they didn't want to hear him. They didn't want to hear about Christ. And he had Gentiles and people who were what we call believers, but they were what we call worshipers. They were sort of converted, but not circumcised in the Jewish religion. They were worshipers, but not circumcised. In chapter 18, listen to verse 6. But when they resisted, the Jewish synagogue, the people of the Jewish synagogue resisted and blasphemed. They blasphemed. They cursed Christ, or they said bad things about Jesus. He shook out his garments, Paul did, and he said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." Now, where did he go? Then he left there, verse 7, and went to the house of a man named Titius. Titius Justus, a worshiper of God, a God-fearer. They used to call him God-fearer. They feared God, but they hadn't been circumcised. They feared the God of Israel. They feared the God of all of creation. So he went next door. Listen to what it says. He went to the house of a man named Titius, a worshiper of God. Listen to the last part of verse 7, whose house was next to the synagogue. So he's telling the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, yeah, women, you have power, but I don't want them carrying messages over here that you guys are coming in here, that you have no, you are so out, you're using your freedom to such an extent that you're coming in here with your heads, uncovered, and you're not showing this proper thing, which was the custom at that time. And we know that the rabbis and so on would make fun of them. He did not want Christianity to be an offense. And several times in the book of Corinthians, and I'll cover that later, and that is, he says this word. Yes, everything's permissible. Yeah, you can do it. Yeah, you've got the freedom to do it. But it's not always beneficial. It's not always the good thing. It doesn't always edify. We'll talk more about this, the word head, the word submit, the word obey, in our next sermon.